This is Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 28th, 2019. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your State Society of CPAs. This, we're going to look at a few developments that took place. First one we're going to talk about is looking at market-based sourcing again, this time a California ruling on directors of a corporation where they held a meeting in the state of California. We'll also take a look at the Chief Counsel's Office has issued some guidance on the use of secured or encrypted email communications with taxpayers and representatives. We'll talk about what options that they will now offer, as well as some of the advice they've given, which may not be the best. So we'll talk about the various ways you could work with it and maybe what you might want to suggest as a way you would work with it if you're going to be working with counsel's office in this regard. We have the tax court got called to decide if the Section 280E denial of all deductions except cost of sales for a marijuana dispensary represented an excessive fine in violation of the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. The court decides no, but there is some division among the judges about why it was no in this case. And we get interim guidance for the Bipartisan Budget Act partnership rules issued to appeals employees. Finally, we also end up this week with a ruling, that comes in where we look at a whistleblower's question. Can a whistleblower force the IRS to continue to examine a taxpayer when the whistleblower says what the IRS has done so far is woefully inadequate, even if the whistleblower was given an award? Well, this week again, we've had our first few sessions, and we started to do some of these California sessions with the California Society. I want to remind you that I will have a rebroadcast coming up on November the 26th. This will be one of those one of those 8-hour sessions. We'll be running it. It'll start at 6 in the morning Pacific time, 8 in the morning Pacific time on that date, and it should be Pacific Standard Time. So depending upon where you are in the country, you know, it will start at anywhere from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. for the first broadcast, anywhere from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. on the second broadcast. It's obviously based on your time zone that says which one of those you probably will choose, or may very well tell you which one of those your state society will decide to offer to you. Again, we'll be covering all the 199 Cap A issues. It will be a rebroadcast of a session I'll be recording here in Phoenix, and we'll go over that. It, again, is a week of Thanksgiving. It's a Tuesday of that week, as I recall. So if you want to get some 199 Cap A discussions, see where we're at, see where we're at with the issues that have arisen regarding all of the informal guidance we've gotten, we'll be talking about that on the session there on the 26th, available from CalCPA and available from a whole number of participating state societies. So check your state society, see what's available, see if you have the option to sign up for this, and if you do, consider signing up for the course. Let's start with our first development this week, and this is looking at market-based sourcing, something the states have been more and more moving toward in deciding what to do about whether to consider a sale into the state to be a sale that counts in as that state sale, depending upon whether it's sold into the state. You know, do you sell into the state? Does that make it a sale? Or is it a sale? Does it count in the state in which the services are performed? Well, this is the case of a California Chief Counsel ruling 2019-03 from the Franchise Tax Board that was issued on October the 7th. This particular case, California is a market-based sourcing case or state, and they have definitely used this even for individual returns. Some states are using this only for apportionment at the corporate level, partnerships, corporations, but California has been using it to test individual taxpayers as well. And that's of interest here because here we have a corporation that was domiciled outside the state of California. It's listed on New York Stock Exchange. And New York Stock Exchange requires majority of the board members to be independent board members. And generally, these board members lived in various states, not necessarily California. However, the company did have some of their board meetings in the state of California. So they bring the board together. The board discusses, makes their, you know, comes, makes their decisions, sends those decisions on to management. Now, the question being posed was, does the fact that these meetings are being held in California mean that what is paid to these directors represents California state income? And if you think about the concept of market-based sourcing, the idea is, well, maybe not. Remember, traditional sourcing said where the service is performed is where the sale would be allocated to. So under traditional sourcing, which now no longer is a majority of the states, but under traditional sourcing, that would have been a California sale because it took place there. The income would have been taxable to the state of California. But the Franchise Tax Board says no, under market-based sourcing, merely being in California for the meeting and doing your service in the state does not necessarily mean that it represents income taxable to the state of California. Rather, under California's rules for market-based sourcing, we look to where a benefit was received by the recipient of these services. In this case, they had to figure out, okay, where did the company receive the benefit? Now, the board of directors, kind of traditional corporate structure, a board is meant to advise and control the appointment of the various top officers of the corporation. Those officers receive the information from the board, and the officers are who carry things out. The Franchise Tax Board decided that in this situation, that benefit of the board meeting, wherever the meeting may be held, is received in the location where the highest ranking officers carry out the board's directions. Generally, you would assume that's going to be where the corporate headquarters is, because that's where the CEO, CFO, etc. most likely are located at, and where those officers are receiving the information, carrying out the instructions, that's where it's going to be considered to be sourced to that state. This is kind of in line with the whole concept of market-based sourcing. Remember, the advantage that the states are sold when they go this route is, first thing is, if you have it the other way, you are discouraging people from holding any board meetings in California. Because, again, the service is performed in California, it's taxable to the state of California. Well, we don't want to pay California tax because that tax is higher than most other states' tax. So maybe we want to hold our board meetings in, I don't know, Las Vegas. You know, yeah, gambling, etc., all kinds of things. Let's hold it in Vegas instead. So the argument being now there's no disadvantage in holding your meeting in California. The directors are not going to be taxed merely because the meeting was held in California. And then secondly, if you have a California-based company, they also get no advantage in going out of the state, because if you go out of the state, you hold that director's meeting in Las Vegas, it doesn't matter. The directors still have to pay tax to California because if the corporate headquarters is, let's say, in the Bay Area, then the benefit's received there. If the benefit's received there, then it's taxable to the state of California. Now, this is an interpretation of market-based sourcing under California's particular statute. And every state has some variance on how they would look at this, but it's likely that California is going to have a high influence in how other states interpret this. At the very least, California is going to, you know, get the first slings and arrows if somebody challenges it and tries to claim that it's, you know, it violates the Constitution, whatever reason it shouldn't work. So the idea being if California gets theirs accepted by the courts, then, hey, it's safer for us to follow them. So we'll have to watch this. Market-based sourcing is a serious issue. If you're not aware, earlier this year we had a screenwriter who was writing for California entities, did not live in California, never was in California, had never set foot in California. Didn't matter. That was considered still to be California income by a California decision earlier this year that's now binding. And that was an appeal of a franchise tax exam that, you know, went after them for that income being located. So market-based sourcing, interesting problem. When it applies, like I said, it's more interesting problem. And the fact that California is using it now, yet again, looking at this from individual tax standpoint, is also very interesting. We've traditionally considered this to be like an apportionment calculation, a corporate-type taxation issue. But nah, individual taxation we're working on in this area as well. Next up, the IRS discovers secure ways to do email, at least Chief Counsel's office does. This is a Chief Counsel Notice, 2020-002. You've got to love it when we've gotten late enough in a year to have 2020 ones. Honestly, why this one's 2020 is because we're heading toward the new fiscal year. We're in the new fiscal year for the IRS, so it's a fiscal year that's going to end in 2020, so apparently Chief Counsel uses fiscal years, not calendar years, to run these, because it's a little early to say, you know, this is stuff we're not going to put out till January. But this notice dealt with communications related to, with the Chief Counsel's office, tax court litigation, probably most CPAs here are not going to be involved in that. You know, there's few of you probably are, you know, eligible to practice for the tax court, but even the people I know have that rarely or never actually take a case there. Private lettering requests is something that CPAs may very well be involved with chief counsel's office, or closing agreements. If any of those are being negotiating with chief counsel's office, we now have methods that the IRS has said employees may begin using immediately, and this was issued on the 18th of October, immediately to start communicating. Now, the methods they're going to approve, there are two methods that they will approve here for secure email. And the IRS has, as we always must have, an acronym or name for these things. And the two methods, the first one is called by the IRS the LBNI Secure Email System, or kind of an acronym, SEMS. What it really is a system that has been in your mail client forever. SMIME. Probably a large portion of you are using Outlook as your mail client, right? That's how you get your mail every day. It's an Outlook. Outlook has had SMIME going back, I think, into the last century. We had SMIME has been in there, you know, SMIME was in there before you started using Outlook. SMIME goes back that far. What SMIME requires is that the party that wants to receive encrypted email, that would be your client or you, because you're representing the client, has to obtain a certificate from a certificate authority for their mail. That's something you pay for, and then gets installed in your computer. It uses something basically that deals with the, you know, where we have this, we have the two keys, the private key cryptography, private public key. There are two keys given. One of them you keep secret at your location, and then you can openly publish the other one. You will effectively send that public key to the IRS. We can just send it in the open. It doesn't matter. The way this works is the public key, whatever's encrypted with one of those keys can only be decrypted by the other. And if all you have is the one key, once it's been run through the encryption, somebody who doesn't have the original text and only has the encrypted text, even though they have that the key that was used to encrypt it, they can't reverse it. So it's a secure transit that is the system, to be honest, that is used to secure web traffic. When you go to Amazon or your bank, that's how we get secure transmissions and encrypted transmissions that can't be broken. We're using this sort of technology. And actually, it's a little more complex than that. Generally, what we end up doing really is, because that has higher overhead, we use that only to negotiate a standard type of encryption key, what you'd think of as a password if you're looking at like an encrypted Acrobat file. And we negotiate that, then we use that, because that kind of, you know, one key encryption is much faster on a processing side. But ignore that little detail. We're going to go with this public key cryptography. Now, like I said, the good news about that is it is very secure. It's been around for a long time. It's functional. It's built into your mail clients. At least it's built into Outlook. If you're using Gmail online, it actually works only with Gmail Enterprise and the Enterprise version. So if you don't have the Enterprise version of Gmail, which is a step up from the business version of email of Gmail, then no, you can't use it there. But you could still use Outlook to retrieve emails that are going through Google Apps. And then then Outlook would go ahead and handle the SMIME part of this. So what happens with SMIME is you get that certificate and exchange it. Now, the other option the IRS offers, if you're not able, and they note right away that this involves some significant technical expertise on the part of the party to be receiving it. The IRS will have their end set up, but you know, you may not feel technical enough to get it done. You may have trouble doing it. Your IT people may not be able to set it up well for you. It does involve some key management, some other issues. And it's not necessarily going to be the simplest thing in the world, because if you're using Outlook on your desktop, you know, that key probably won't be on your phone. So you won't be able to decrypt it on the phone. So if you get the message, you got to get back to your desktop. I mean, there are various reasons why you may find it messy. Then they're going to use this thing, which they call SecureZip, an encrypted email attachment. And what all it's going to be is a zip file with a password, right? That's going to be the structure. And in that case, you can decrypt it with a number of free decryption software, so there's nothing fancy. If you want to send something to the IRS, you then again zip it up and give a password on it, so we go back and forth. The problem with that structure, pretty obvious, you got to get the passwords back and forth. And for that reason, the IRS prefers the S/MIME option. And definitely it's the cleanest one if you can get it set up. And I'm going to suggest to you, if you work with counsel's office and you're going to having and you want to be able to use this type of process to be able to communicate with them using the email clients, I would strongly suggest you bite the bullet, get a consultant in, and get S/MIME set up. So you have your certificates ready and you're ready to communicate with these people using the secure transfer. It will definitely save you a lot of time and bother. But if you don't do that and you're going for the zip files, the IRS does say good news. Don't send the password. Don't send an email with the zip file attached. And then in the email say, oh, by the way, the password for this is whatever it is. As I said, that at least they recognize that's obviously bad. The problem is, though, they then go on to suggest how to transmit it otherwise. And they actually do, which is, as far as I'm concerned, horribly bad. Advice. They tell people that, well, the first one's not too bad. You could just call up over the phone. Of course, got trouble writing that down. We have issues. Or to give them the password. Or they say you could just put in a separate email. That one I have trouble with because, let's face it, why are we sending things encrypted via email? Because we are concerned that somebody may be intercepting the emails and reading them. Well, if they intercepted the email with the zip file in it, right? The one has whatever we zipped up, PDF scans, whatever. If they could intercept that, there's a really good chance they could intercept the second email that's going to have the password. And if they know you're a CPA firm or a law firm, and they know you're communicating with the IRS this way, then it's really pretty simple for them to just kind of grab that other thing coming through. So I would certainly suggest S/MIME makes a lot more sense. One caveat with either of them, the IRS memo makes very clear, is in neither case, S/MIME nor this attach a secured zip to the email, neither one of those is going to encrypt anything in the subject line. So they are very clear that the subject line, and when you're sending back to them, same thing would be true, should never contain any personally identifiable information. You know, good old PII, all that stuff. Like their social security numbers be a bad thing to have in the subject line. Any other information that would be considered confidential in nature. You know, all of that should all be inside of the zip file or inside the secured email. That's what you should be doing. So that's one thing that they strongly suggest. It'll be interesting to see if this guidance, you know, makes its way downstream and we start to see the auditors begin to use this kind of structure as well. If so, then yeah, you're probably going to need to get somebody to get you up to speed on S/MIME and get your certificates and get those certificates installed. That's going to be an issue, but this at least counsel's office is starting this process. We'll see if it moves downstream. Next up, we have the case of Northern California Small Business Assistance Inc. versus Commissioner. It's a published tax court decision, 153 TC number 4, issued on October the 23rd. And yes, we're going back to marijuana one more time. We've had a series of cases over the past couple of years, and this is yet another published case that deals with a marijuana dispensary. In this case, the dispensary argues that Section 280 Cap E represents an excessive fine. And that sort of excessive fine would be in violation of the Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says that excessive bail should not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Of course, they're saying this is an excessive fine being imposed for them selling marijuana. It gets interesting because why is that an issue? For those who don't know about 280, you haven't done any work here in the marijuana area. I assume a lot of you haven't. Section 280 provides that if you are selling a federally controlled substance or anything that's state illegal, you're not allowed to take deductions aside from the deduction you can claim for the actual cost of sales. So that means things like the salaries you're paying your sales staff there in the store, the cleaning, the janitorial cleaning, the utilities to keep the lights on in the building, you know, air conditioning, all that sort of stuff, the equipment that you buy. Basically, all that stuff is going to be non-deductible in full. And they're saying, well, that results in a huge tax, which, by the way, it does. And they were saying, well, this represents an excessive fine, and as such, it's unconstitutional. So as such, you should just ignore 280 cap E. Well, the tax court did not grant the taxpayer that ruling, but the court disagreed on why that ruling would not be granted. The official majority opinion, and again, as a reported case, it went before the entire court. And, you know, and I think two judges did not participate, but otherwise we have everybody in the mix. You know, a majority of the court held that a denial of a deduction never can be a fine. They held that the 16th Amendment allows Congress to tax gross incomes. The allowance of any deduction is a matter of legislative grace. They used that line in there. And stating that, therefore, a denial of a deduction could never be considered the equivalent of a fine, which is a criminal-type sanction. And so because of that, you can't prevail on this, regardless of whether it's excessive or not. You just can't prevail. Now, two judges decided that, wait, we're not ready to say it, that a denial of deduction could never be a fine. We're not going to say it could be either. And we're not going to say specifically whether 280E would be a fine in any circumstance. We're just saying that, you know what? The taxpayer in this case, Northern California Small Business Assistance, Inc., the corporation didn't present evidence about why this would be excessive. They said, so it doesn't really matter if it is or is not a fine, because whether it's a fine or not, you know, unless we have some evidence of it being excessive, because obviously we can charge fines, it's just not relevant. So two judges said, we're not going to decide whether a denial of deduction could be a fine. We're just going to say it's irrelevant here because there's nothing in the record to tell us about why it would be considered excessive. But then three other judges took it even further. Those three said, no, 280E obviously is a fine. It is a charge being imposed for doing something, you know, that essentially Congress treats as illegal. And they're stating that, okay, it is a fine, but they said, here's your problem. Now we go back to the other two judges. There's no evidence about what it would take for this to be excessive or not excessive. Without evidence of it being excessive, then there's not a whole lot we can do for you. Sorry. So while all the judges agreed that the taxpayer couldn't prevail on this issue, they did disagree on why. Of course, since it is a published decision, and since the court has to follow it going forward, the majority is going to control here. But it could be interesting if this gets appealed, and this is a California case, so it would go to the Ninth Circuit. If you haven't noticed, almost all the marijuana cases are going to the Ninth or Tenth Circuit. They're basically coming out of California and Colorado are the places where we're seeing these cases come out of. Will the Ninth Circuit consider this? Will they look at it as a theory? It's interesting. We'll just have to see, you know, how it works. There is one other topic discussed here. They had a couple of other theories about why they should be able to claim deductions, and the court didn't buy any of them. But one of the ones they didn't buy is kind of interesting because sometimes people try to argue this. The taxpayer argued, well, okay, even if 280E bars deductions, it only bars ordinary and necessary business expenses under 162. And that means that if another section of the code allows us a deduction, like 164 for taxes or 167 for depreciation, that we should get that deduction. Well, the tax court, and nobody disagreed with this, the tax court said, sorry guys, don't get it. They said the very beginning of section 280E says that no deduction or credit shall be allowed for any amount paid or incurred during the year in carrying on any trade or business. They said, look, and they said statutorily, section 161 says that effectively anything that is located here in part 9 of subchapter B of all, of chapter 1 of the code, those bars on deductions apply to anything up above in the 162 down through, you know, the 162 and on sections that talk about deductions. And so because this falls into that category, 280E is in that section, they're saying, look, it bars it. You can't claim a deduction. 161 says you can't. So 164 and 167 are limited by that exception. This becomes interesting because it suggests that anything that's found in that area, which by the way does include Section 199 Cap A, would apparently be off limits. Now, the AICPA had some commentary letter that suggested that, well, okay, it's paid or incurred as part of the deal, so a marijuana dispensary should get 199 Cap A. Let's be very clear, this case did not rule on 199 Cap A. Those cases are to come. But if you take this at face value, first thing I would say is, well, is depreciation paid or incurred? And if it's incurred, then you might argue 199 Cap A is incurred in the same sense. And so, yeah, it doesn't look good if they follow this theory going forward as how they would look at the way it would be barred. But again, kind of interesting discussion and another discussion to have later. But the big takeaway and why this is a published opinion is obviously due to that fines rule, the excessive fines problem in the Eighth Amendment. Next up, we now have, remember we have brand new audit rules now for partnerships? We now have in Memorandum AP08-1019-0013, issued on October the 18th of 2019, the IRS has issued interim guidance to appeals employees regarding procedures that are going to be used in cases involving the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015's revision to the partnership audit rules. This temporary guidance is going to be in place until October 18, 2021, or at least expires then. It very well will be replaced before then, and it's waiting for IRM Section 18.9 to be revised. Now, it deals with the following phases of the Bipartisan Budget Act rules for tax for audits of partnerships. Remember, beginning in 2018, taxpayers, you know, partnerships are under this Bipartisan Budget Act centralized partnership examination rule unless they were eligible to and did opt out. A lot of partnerships were not eligible to opt out. If you had a single member LLC as a partner, if you have a partnership as a partner, if you have a grantor trust as a partner, any of those meant you couldn't opt out. So there's a lot of partnerships that can't opt out. And so they said, well, all of these things potentially could come to appeals. So first, there's the early election. I don't know anybody did that, but in theory, if you had a partnership year that began after they passed the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015, which was in November of 2015, all the way up through the beginning of 2018, even though it didn't have to apply to you, if you got examined, you can elect in early. I don't know of anybody who's done it yet, but if they do, we have procedures that they would use for those. That obviously will become a moot point in a few years. They also have a section on administrative adjustment requests. Now, this is important because, remember, under the Bipartisan Budget Act, the only way we have to deal with these things, we can't amend a partnership return, in reality, like you used to. It's not like you go back and you change the return and then the partner goes back and amends his return for the year in question. Now under the BBA, since we're past the due date for filing calendar year 2018 returns, if you make a change now to the partnership return for 2018, we don't go back and change their 18 individual return. Rather, we now have to pick up, assuming we get this administrative adjustment request handled during 2019 and we decide to push it out. We either pay the tax in 19, or we do the push out, and then the partners would end up paying it this year. Well, obviously the IRS could challenge your AAR computations. That could end up in exam, so that could end up before appeals. We have the notice to propose partnership adjustments. That's right at the end of it, before you have a right to go in and modify things. If there are disputes there that can go to appeals, we have that covered here. We have disputes over modifications that can be allowed. They have procedures for that. And then finally, if we get down to the notice of final partnership adjustments, your appeal there, and obviously if that doesn't work in appeals, you end up going into tax court, at least apparently can. This document has a 21-page appendix, which also has a glossary of terms for the Bipartisan Budget Act. Remember, this is a brand new way of doing partnership exams. If you've not gotten into this, if you haven't really, you know, gotten your arms around how this thing works, probably not a bad idea to do so, and so we'll take a look and go down that path. Finally, this week, we have a case for a whistleblower. And I'm going to get his name wrong, I know. Aprizzi, versus Commissioner, Task Group Memorandum Decision, 2019-141. I apologize to the whistleblower. It's October 21st, 2019. Now, this is a, you know, generally you know that if you're a whistleblower, you basically point the IRS toward tax that is due. And the IRS is able to collect some of that tax, they get it, then you can be awarded a portion of this. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. The taxpayer in this case, actually there was this, the person who filed this, plus they had a co-claimant. So the two of them submitted information that an estate had omitted and undervalued assets. At the time they did that and filed the form for whistleblower, the Form 211 application for award for original information, filed to the whistleblower's office, the IRS was in the middle of examining the estate, and the agent was ready to close it with no change. With the information provided by these two, the IRS reopened, you know, IRS went back in and looked at it again, began to look at these other issues, and they actually decided that, yep, you know what, there's tax due, we're adjusting. Well, the estate and the IRS then got into discussions, and the IRS and the estate agreed to settle for just over $420,000. Problem. The whistleblower's got an award based on it, okay? They got their award paid. So they got an award based on the $424,000. But as we said, it was $43,400 and some. The taxpayer, you know, or not taxpayer in this case, the whistleblowers are saying, wait a minute, there were millions of dollars that should have been collected. This is way too low. You know, this is, you know, this just, you know, the IRS, we want them to go examine this and collect more because it should be, and then we would get a bigger award. You know, they wanted the tax court to order the IRS to reopen an exam, which they said was woefully inadequate. You know, that number is just way too low. Should be several million dollars of missing estate tax. Well, the problem is the tax court found no authority under the statute that allows for a whistleblower claim that allows you to go back and change. The whistleblower statute merely says if you provide information and if the IRS then collects tax based on the information, and that and there's nothing in there that says they have to go check it or they have to go get the tax, they have to go get a maximum tax, or you can insert yourself in as a second examining agent. Rather, whatever they get is what your award's based on. And there is no authority for the court to reorder them. So even if this was a woefully inadequate exam, reality is the whistleblower doesn't have the authority. The court doesn't have the authority to, you know, say, hey, the whistleblower wants to be in the middle of this because the whistleblower, you know, thinks you've got to do more work, that you're missing big things. Whistleblower doesn't have that level of review. It is CPE season, and we're serious now, and I know that because I just got back from the road. I'm going on the road. I'm going to be on the road the entire week coming up for continuing education. I'll be in on Monday and Tuesday of this week. I will be in Albuquerque. I'll be doing depreciation, repairs, and fixed assets, tax considerations. On the 29th, I'm going to do 2 4-hour courses, one on accounting, auditing, and tax consideration for the cannabis industry, and one new businesses advising clients on related tax issues. Those are both 4-hour courses on the 29th. Both of these courses will be taped for rebroadcast by CalCPA later in the year. So if you can't make it to Albuquerque, we are going to get another shot at these if you want to take these courses later on. I will then go that evening. Be interesting. I actually can get from Albuquerque to Seattle, so I'll be in Seattle on the 30th that afternoon, and I'll be doing a session, Trust, What is Accounting Income and Other Issues for Income Taxation of Trust, at the Pacific Tax Institute. The Pacific Tax Institute will be running on the 29th and 30th. Obviously, I'm there day two on the 30th. If you want to go to the Pacific Tax Institute, you can still sign up at the Washington Society website, and look forward to seeing you there. Finally, at the last 2 days of this week, I'll be doing 2 days in Idaho. First, partnership and S corporations, basis and distribution issues. IRS has become very interested in that area now. As you may notice, we have a lot more basis and reporting information we've talked about this year they're looking at. And then on Friday, I'll be doing that Section 199 Cap A course, Explored Planning for Qualified Business Income. That's the course we're going to have the rebroadcast on late in November. But you want to take it now. Idaho will offer it both live in Boise, and they will offer it as a webcast. So you know, you can set in then and find out about 199 cap 8. So whatever you've got, you know, go ahead, take a look at your state society options, take a look at what you can sign up for. And, you know, I'm going to be out doing a lot of courses over the next few weeks. So I'll be around various places doing courses. I look forward to seeing some of you. We just added a couple of new courses in Connecticut, looks like, going to be handling in December. So that'll be interesting. And, you know, we've got other cases, or other, not cases, but courses all around the country. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of October the 28th, 2019. You can follow along on our website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where we publish every day, or at least regularly, I should say, during the week, updates on what's been happening in taxes. If you want to send me questions or comments, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com is a good place to send them. That way I'll know it relates to the discussions here or the CP courses. That's a better place. Yes, I know I have my own address out there for the firm on a few places, but yeah, this is by far the better. The firm address I use for client emails, and non-client emails tend to get shoved to the side, that account, so it's not a good account to use for for things like this. Go use the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com email address is the best thing to use. I also am following along on the Reddit group /r/taxpros, and also discussion groups run by various state societies. I'm part of the Cal CPA group, which for the moment is at groups.yahoo.com, Tax Talk. It is probably moving to groups.io coming here shortly, because Yahoo, you know, Verizon is quietly shutting down, slowly squeezing away the Yahoo groups. So we're going to be moving that over. And if you're there, you know about that. Also, I'm on three state societies for their private listservs. That'll be the Connect groups for Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey. So if you have some issues, you can post there. Otherwise, look forward to seeing you guys next week. It's been fun. I've been on the road. I've been in the Northeast the last couple of weeks. And now I'm going to go ahead and start hitting the Western U.S. The week after that, I get a little bit of a breather with some infirm stuff. And then following that, I do some Arizona work. Eventually, I hit the road again. I get to Minneapolis, and I get to New Jersey. Yes, we are doing advanced tax in New Jersey later this month, so you can take a look at that. And then, you know, start moving around. So it gets really fun through the end of the year. So we look forward to seeing you guys coming up in those courses, if you can make it there. Otherwise, you know, stay tuned. Neat things are happening here in Current Federal Tax Developments.